and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Numbers continue to slip. Why? It's the economy, stupid. Economist Dr. Julian Malveau deep dives with us into the numbers. And author Charlotte Dennett says to see what's really fueling the genocide in Gaza, follow the pipelines. And good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Donald Trump's approval rating is lower than any other president in modern history at this time in their presidency. This time meaning that period is the first August during the first year of their term. Trump's approval rating is averaging at 40% depending on the poll. Rasmussen reported 48% and Quinnipiac reported 37%. Comparatively, President Biden was 49%, President Obama was 53%, George W. Bush was 56% approval, Bill Clinton, 44% approval, George H.W. Bush was 69% approval, Ronald Reagan was 60% approval. But again, this is just the first August of the term, and so many factors and events can influence the public's opinion of the president's performance. In Trump's case, deporting thousands of immigrants, leaving farmers and restaurant work without restaurant workers, firing hundreds of thousands of government employees and expert personnel in critical fields, imposing illegal tariffs on longtime trading partners, declaring war on free speech, the war in Ukraine, the genocide in Gaza, and most importantly, the economy. Or as political strategist James Carville said once, it's the economy, stupid. Dr. Julian Malveau is a labor economist and colleague of mine at WPFW. She hosts the Julian Malveau Show on WPFW Mondays at 9 a.m. And she's currently working on a new book titled Black Money, Then, Now, and in the Future. She joins me now in the studio to help us closely analyze what's happening with the economy. Good morning, Dr. Malveau, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning, Verna. Thank you for the invite. Quick correction. I did see this on the rundown. And I forgot to correct it. That's an old book. This book I'm working on now is called Lynching Culture, The Wealth Gap and Reparations.
Lynching Culture,
The Wealth Gap and Reparations.
Okay.
Direct line between where we are, where Black people are economically, and the culture of lynching that just allowed them to take our stuff.
Yes. Speaking of lynchings, there were, I don't know if there were lynchings or not, but there were two young men found hanging.
Yes, in Mississippi. They didn't hang themselves. One of them had broken bones. How do you climb up on a stool with broken bones? And I don't have the details. I just find it highly unlikely. And Delta State University has a fairly racially balanced student body. But that often leads to different problems than when you have, at least different problems. Mm-hmm. And if you have Black folks and the minority, our presence is often very threatening. Mm-hmm. It's a very sad situation. One of the young men was just 22. But we need to wait. We need to do what we ask others to wait to get the information.
Because
it's easy to speculate all kinds of things.
And it is.
They will be. Cash Patel, I'm sure, will be on his soapbox claiming something or other. He was disgraceful yesterday, but then he's disgraceful every time he sits down and opens his mouth. But I mean,
in his performance before Congress, you're speaking of.
Yes. His blatant disrespect of Cory Booker was ridiculous, but it was obviously racially motivated. Plus, he takes a page from his boss's book. He takes his page from NASA. And NASA runs around hollering and screaming, and so he's doing the same thing, calling names, and not answering questions.
Okay, so back to the subject that we want to talk about this morning. Trump promised to lower prices for essentials like housing and groceries. There was much talk about the price of a carton of eggs when he went to office. Has the price of eggs increased or decreased? Have the effects of Trump's illegal tariffs hit the grocery stores yet, Dr. Mavo?
Well, you know, he promised to fix the economy, and basically, in a word, he didn't. Inflation is ticking up. It's not jumping up, but it's ticking up. But we want inflation to be down, and it's up. And the last month showed yet another increase. Prices are up, and big prices as well as little prices. So many people are talking about the price of groceries. Food banks are reporting that they have increased traffic because more and more people are hungry or scrambling to be able to eat and to feed their families. The inflation story now, interest rates will probably, the Fed meets today, and it's very likely that there'll be a quarter of a percentage point drop, might even be a little more, but that's not because of anything Trump has been pushing. He's been pushing the Fed in horrible ways, calling Jerry Powell all out of his name, anything he wants to call him, and of course the attack on Lisa Cook. Both affects our nation. The Trump administration actually tried to prevent her from attending the meeting today, but mm-hmm. the Supreme Court proved that she could indeed not only attend the meeting but participate as she always does and vote. But we will see interest rates go down a little because the unemployment rate is going up.
Yeah.
Before
we go to the unemployment, so the Federal Reserve, as you said, they're meeting today. She is participating in that meeting, Lisa Cook. And I think it's still up in the air as to whether or not she's going to be allowed to vote during the meeting. And of course, Trump tried to bully Jerome Powell, the chair, into lowering the rates, which he's convinced will boost the economy. So Dr. Mavo, it's predicted that he will lower the interest rates today, but explain the connection between interest rates and our pocketbook issues, because it's not really going to affect the price of gasoline or eggs or clothing, is it? Or is it only going to affect if you're buying a house or a car or a jet plane or a vacation home or a large loan and credit cards, correct? Tell us what's the connection between
the interest rate is the price of money. It's what you pay to get money, like if you're borrowing for business expansion. I mean, the Trump theory, the theory of many of those administration economists is that if money is cheaper, people will borrow more so they can expand. But we didn't see that happen in 2008 when we had a recession and interest rates went very low. The economy didn't expand because credit requirements were so high that, you know, the Trump cronies could go get a loan. But Werner, if you and I said we want to go into business and start a $1 million boutique, nobody was going to lend us the money. Because you might have a better credit than
me. I think it's safe to say we.
But in any case, the theory is that if money is cheaper, people will borrow it, and that will cause economic expansion. Doesn't always happen that way. Didn't happen at the end of COVID either, when the interest rate got down to almost zero, which meant money was free, but of course, it was only free if you could qualify for it. So the connection between the interest rate and inflation and prices, however, well, obviously, you know the connection between inflation and prices. Inflation up, prices up. Mm-hmm. Inflation down. And here's the other thing, a little interesting caveat for you and your listeners. Prices very rarely go down. Economists have a thing called sticky downward, which means once you establish a price. Now, we see gasoline prices fluctuate, but if we talk about something like automobile prices, once they say this car is $50,000, believe me, next season it may still be 50 when they could have taken it up to 52, but it's not going down to 48. Once they've established a price, they very rarely will reduce a price. So theoretically, when inflation goes down, prices should go down. Doesn't always happen that way. Now, in terms of the interest rate and prices, I mean, the prices are closely connected to inflation. And so the interest rate again, it's just it's the price of money. Just look at it that way. Money costs.
So the theory is that they're going to get more money to spend in the economy.
Exactly.
And boost the economy.
Which will make the economy expansionary, which is important because several economists have predicted that we're going into something called a stagflation. It's a combination of stagnation and inflation. Inflation will continue. Inflation is supposed to, lower price help the economy expand. We have not controlled inflation well. Even if we go down by a quarter percentage point, inflation may do whatever it feels like doing. So stagflation is economic stagnation. It's not recession. It's just stagnation. It's like that nothing happens over the course of a quarter. You start, GDP growth is X. You end, it's X. There's no activity. So stagnant.
No movement up or down.
Exactly.
And we want to see movement in the economy going up.
Absolutely.
Okay. So Trump promised to create 25 million new jobs in 10 years. And of course, it's still only the middle of year one, but the unemployment rate is headed in the wrong direction. He promised to reduce government efficiency and put Elon Musk in charge of Doge. Do we know how many jobs were eliminated and what impact does a high unemployment rate have on a struggling economy?
The last number I saw was at least 100,000. At least, and that's a small number, but it has ripple effects. If the Department of Energy closes and it's on 16th and K, which it isn't, but I'm just using that as an example, all those restaurants around 16th and K are part of the ecosystem of that office building. Now, if you've been downtown lately at noontime, you don't see what we used to see 5 years ago, pre-COVID. You go downtown, go to K Street, go to Connecticut Avenue at lunchtime, and you always see a crowd. Now you don't always see a crowd. In fact, we've seen restaurants closing, in ways that we've never seen before. But no, Trump did not do anything for the economy, and the cuts hurt the economy, and they hurt the D.C. downtown economy in particular. And, many organizations are renegotiating their leases. Many are leasing out some of their own office space because once we went to a lot of remote work, people don't have to come to work every day. And so that's also had an impact on the economy. One of the numbers, Bernard, that's been thrown around a lot, it's a number we should pay attention to, is the 300,000 Black women who lost their jobs.
Yes.
300,000. Yes. People want to know because of the last unemployment report, there's a piece of data, it's called the employment population ratio. It's a percentage of the population that works. It's not the unemployment rate or the labor force participation rate. It's a raw. There are 100,000 Black women in the economy and 30,000 of them have jobs, or 300,000 have that. That MPOP then would be something like 0.3. Well, the MPOP is actually about 0.6, but in the last unemployment report, for every group of people, white men, white women, Black men, Latinas, Latinos, for every group, the MPOP went down a tiny little bit by a tenth of a percentage point. But for Black women, it went down by 2%. By 2%. That's a huge, huge, huge and noticeable difference. And what bothers me the most about it is that people don't talk about it, so we get to talk about it. But, we don't see a lot about this on the mainstream media. And I guess Black women are just not that important to the rest of the world. But we should... So that why is it such a hit for Black women? Number one, government employment. We are disproportionately employed by government. 18%. We are 6% of the population. We Black women, roughly 6%, and we're about 12% of the federal employment. So altogether, Black people are 18%, but Black women bear the biggest slice because it's the clerical works, the admins, all of that, in addition to the professionals. But you find many of us concentrated among the admins. So when you let a GS-14 go, or someone who's middle management, everybody who supported her is on the chopping block too. Maybe not all go, maybe they have reduced duties or combined jobs. But so in any case, that's part of it. That's a big part of it, is the government employment. Then there is a DEI component. In response to this president, many corporations started cutting back their DEI efforts. Those efforts were predominantly housed with Black women. We tended to be the affirmative action officer, the head of diversity, equity, and belonging. They tended to be, not always, certainly not always, but it tended to be. So as companies cut that back, many Black women were let go. And then we weren't picked up in the corresponding industries. Hospital employment has stayed relatively stable, but we're in hospital employment, but it did not expand. So there was no room for us to expand. So we're concentrated in the wrong industries, primarily. The other places where you find us is not just federal government employee, but state and local government employee.
So now, is there any figure comparatively to that 300,000 for African-American women? Is there a similar figure for white women? Because they would have been affected.
White women gained employment during that time period. White women gained employment. Their impact dropped a little bit, but they gained employment. Not a lot, because we only gained 22,000 jobs in the last report. But if they gained 1,000, it's more than better than losing 300,000.
Okay, so now the midterm elections will be in just a little over 1 year away on November 3rd, 2026. And that's an opportunity for the country to weigh in on how the president is doing in his first term. Democrats need to win 3 seats in the House and 4 in the Senate in order to regain control of the Congress. So, Dr. Malvo, labor economist and author, do you think, what kind of effect do you think that will have on the nation's ability to sort of control Trump? Do you think that's likely to happen?
I have mixed feelings. I mean, the Trumpies, the MAGAites, are so rabid and so blindly devoted to this president. I mean, they're blindly devoted. As he said once, he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. Well, so I'm not sure how many of them would turn on him, and that's what he would see it as. And we see now also he has the tools of retaliation. So there are Republicans, I believe, who do have good sense. However, they don't exhibit it. I mean, they are too willing to go along with him. If they would, you know, I think with the issue of trying to censure the sister from New Jersey, Congresswoman who has federal charges against her, LaMonica McIver. There was a motion to censor. 4 Republicans voted against it. Only 4. Now, these people are running around talking about free speech. They want to censor her for some of her words around a kerfuffle at an ICE facility. She still faces federal charges, but Congress wants to censor her. So if they wussed out on that, that means that 200 of them were willing to, 200 plus were willing to censor her. Are some of them willing to step up and basically go against this president? On the flip side, Verna, and the good news is that right now, I think we have approximately, I don't have the numbers on top of my head, but I'd say at least 30, and it may be closer to 40, members of Congress who said they're not coming back. They're tilted on about a 2-to-1. They're tilted Republican. So one of the things we can think is that we know that Democrats will probably hold their seats because the way Congress has been gerrymandered, there are very few openly competitive seats. So Dems will probably hold their seats, and then the question will be, can they get 5 or 6 or 7 of those Republican seats with Republicans stepping down? And the answer is that's certainly possible. We don't know if it's probable, but it's certainly possible. So that is a ray of hope. But other than that, we know that the midterms are going to be very challenging because of the changes in Texas. You know, 5 seats there. Now, that still has to survive a court battle. In Missouri, the same thing is happening. The governor has signed legislation for redistricting. So we have 2 states that are doing that, and others may do so as well. They'll have to act really quickly because usually you need a year lead in terms of doing maps and all of that. So as you said earlier, 2 months they can do all their dirt within the next 2 months, and mm-hmm. then it's going to be pretty much set. So I think it could go either way. I know lots of Republicans mm-hmm. who are very disgusted with this administration and don't like what's going on. But they say it to me. They say it to their Democratic friends. They say it to each other. But they wouldn't say it on anybody's air, nor would they say it in public. And that's the problem.
And they vote according to Trump's dictates while they're in Congress. So now, are there any statistics, Dr. Malvo, of how small businesses are being impacted by Trump's illegal tariffs?
We don't have any data as yet. We'll see some of that data, you know, toward the end of the year, because many small businesses will be affected by the tariffs in terms of the gift-giving season. The holiday season is a big thing for lots of people. People give a lot of money. People spend a lot of money during the holiday season. But how will spending be impacted by the tariffs? You know, when you look at all the junk that people have, I'm not dissing people who buy junk for their children, but all the junk that people have under their Christmas trees, if you look at it, half of it is made in China. All those little tchotchkes.
Another half in Mexico, probably.
Now, Mexico's not huge on manufacturing, but they do some stuff, and they're doing more. But in mm-hmm. any case, what we're going to see is a depressed Christmas season, more than likely, with people mm-hmm. spending less. If food is more expensive, you know how we feast at Christmas time, it would probably be a slightly leaner feast mm-hmm. or different food on the table.
Well, what food? Because we know the farmers might have been impacted as well.
Very much so, yeah.
But they had said we would see fewer avocados and things of that nature. But do we know which products are being impacted by these tariffs, and how the farmers are doing?
The farmers are not doing well. The ones in the Midwest are complaining. First of all, they're complaining about the worker shortage. Even though the unemployment rate is ticking up, not everybody is lining up to take a job in agriculture. So we've seen an impact on farm production domestically. Internationally, especially in our region, what we've seen from Canada and from Mexico is that these increased tariffs will turn into increased prices. What's happening in the short, you see it in the grocery store today. If you were buying, my brother commented on it yesterday that he spent $2 on our avocado that I asked him to pick up. I told him, I said, I did not ask you to pick up a $2 avocado. It doesn't go down to the 139s. But he was just commenting, he's from California. He's visiting and he was just commenting how much more expensive produce is here. And I said, yeah, because y'all sitting on top of Mexico. And everything you buy, you'll see now. Here's going to be the trick. You're not going to see it right away. And because mm-hmm. you don't see it right away, sometimes out of sight, out of mind. So when people go to the polls in November of 26, what are they going to be thinking? I mean, will they find prices manageable? Will they have been inured to increasing prices? And being so inured, will they say, well, this is just kind of how it is, which is often what happens because Americans have short memories when it comes to both the economy and to political actions. So I have a huge question mark in my head about what's going to happen with the midterms. But what I do know about the midterms is that they're going to be among the most impactful. And people always say that. I hate it when they say it, and now I'm saying it. But these will be impactful midterms. I can't say the most impactful ever, but they will be impactful, especially because this will be the first test of this president on how the public is feeling about him. Mm-hmm. We see that his polls numbers are slipping, and his behavior is turning off a lot of Republicans who believe in decorum. And, you know, he calls people thugs. He calls people out of their name. Yesterday, he told some reporter something about, well, we might come after you. And then Gandhi said he was just joking. But he wasn't joking. He's gone after others. A sister at the Washington Post, Ms. Appiah, was fired because of something she said in her email that to me seemed quite innocuous. But anyway, mm-hmm. she lost her job over it. So we're the midterm is a referendum. How you like me now?
That's pretty good, Dr. Malvo. So, but we know that the latest report shows that retail spending is up just slightly, despite his tariffs. So the question is whether that will continue in that direction.
Well, there's a lag. Tariffs are imposed. Once the tariffs are imposed, people have to adjust their prices. Some of the things that are being imported were purchased in July, are shipped over here, and now they have to collect the tariff at the port. So something you thought you were going to have to pay, let's say $1,000 for, you now have to pay roughly $1,500 for because of the tariff. And that's a, are you prepared to do that? So we're not going to see it right away. The prices on tariffs is a lagging indicator. It doesn't happen immediately. Very little, and that's one of the things about the way that the economic news is reported, is people report that tariffs went up. People don't see it, and they say, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. And it's like, mm-hmm. Give it a month. Give it 2 months.
Well, we shall see, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Federal Reserve today. They'll be making their report later today. Dr. Julian Malvo, labor economist and author of several books, including Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes, Perspectives of a Mad Economist. Thank you, Dr. Malvo, for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you, and thanks for the work you do.
Yes, indeed. Up next, what's really fueling Israel's genocide in Gaza? Author Charlotte Dennett says the answer lies in her book titled Follow the Pipelines. She joins me in the studio in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of Monday, September 15th, 2025. Wednesday, September 17th, the Claudia Jones School for Political Education and Code Pink invite you to a discussion on solidarity with Venezuela and a look into Venezuela's communes. 7 p.m. at the Institute for Policy Studies at 1301 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest, D.C. More info can be found on codepink.org/DC917. Also on Wednesday, September 17th at 6 p.m., Mothers Outreach Network Parents Know Your Rights workshop will take place at Potomac Garden Community Center, 712 Street, Southeast Washington, D.C. For more info, visit eventbrite.com. On Wednesday, September 17th from 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe will host a screening of American Exile and the Adventures of Ile Imole, centered around connecting spirit to history, located on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit Sankofa.com. Finally, on Thursday, September 18th, Third Thursday's Reflection and Restoration Hour of Quiet Reflection and Restoration for those fighting for peace and justice in the communities. It will take place from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Seekers Church, 276 Carroll Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. For further info, contact Sandra at SeekersChurch.org. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm still Verna Avery Brown, and her father was America's first master spy in the Middle East, and he died mysteriously on a top secret mission to Saudi Arabia in 1947. Charlotte Dennett was 6 weeks old at the time. Today, she is an award-winning author, an attorney, and an investigative journalist. The title of her book, Follow the Pipelines, Uncovering the Mystery of the Lost Spy and the Deadly Politics of the Great Game for Oil. And she joins me in the studio this morning on What's at Stake. Good morning, Charlotte Dennett. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Now, your book makes the case that the horrific genocide we're being forced to witness unfolding daily on our TV screens has less to do with religion and who has the biblical right to occupy the Gaza Strip, and more to do with who will control the vast oil and gas reserves on the coast of Gaza. And your story begins with your father, Daniel Dennett's top secret trip to Saudi Arabia. What was the mission your father, Daniel Dennett, who now incidentally has a wing named after him in the, at the CIA, what was the top secret mission he was assigned to do in Saudi Arabia?
His mission was to determine the route of a new pipeline in the Middle East. It was going to be called TAPLINE, the Trans-Arabian Pipeline. And the reason that he had to determine the route is because pipelines historically have often been sabotaged. These are, as one of his colleagues said, the arteries of empire. Oil doesn't do any good for those who seek its energy sitting in the ground. It has to be distributed. It used to be primarily by tanks, but by the end of the World War II, more and more it was being distributed by pipelines. And the security of the pipeline is crucial. So I discovered this because my father's last report was given to my mother and my father's last letter home. So I read both of those and I began to understand the huge dimension of what Saudi oil was going to mean, not only for the United States, but for Europe after the war. It was going to supplant coal, which was controlled largely by communist unions in Europe, with oil. And it would eventually turn the United States into a superpower, not only in the Middle East, but in the world. So that was part of what I discovered looking at his last report and last letter home. And then I found this great article in the New York Times, and I have it right here, March 2nd, 1947. And its title is Pipeline for U.S. Adds to Middle East Issues. And then the subtitle, I think, is very interesting. Oil concessions raise questions involving the position of Russia. We're still at it. The great game.
So your father was to determine where this pipeline would begin and end? Is that it?
Yeah,
is that what his mission was?
Absolutely. Whether it would terminate in Lebanon or in Haifa, which was still then Palestine. In fact, I would really encourage people, if they want to understand the Middle East, you've got to get out the maps. And the East, the whole Eastern Mediterranean is a crucial part of the world. Because there are pipelines that terminate on the Eastern Mediterranean, and that means in Israel and Lebanon and Syria.
Okay, so his plane crashed 2 weeks after he filed his report. Is that accurate?
Correct. Yeah,
okay.
You got it.
So were you able to get hold of his top secret report, and where did he report that the pipeline should terminate? Was it Lebanon or Palestine?
He favored Lebanon because there was too much conflict going on in Palestine at the time. The Jews were fighting the Brits. They wanted independence. And the Arabs were fighting the Jews because they didn't want the Jews to take over their land. So it was immersed in conflict. And one of the things I learned early on is that if you're going to have any big infrastructure projects, you can't have conflict. I mean, in a way, it makes sense. And that will take us up to Gaza, by the way, to explain what's going on in Gaza. But that was an early lesson I got. And also from this article, which I found this very interesting, it says, protection of that investment, that means the pipeline, and the military and economic security that it represents inevitably will become one of the prime objectives of American foreign policy in this area, which already has become a pivot of world politics and one of the main focal points of rivalry between East and West, and that means between the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Now, who's that article? Who wrote that article? Where is that from?
The New York Times. It was written, interestingly, by Clifton Daniel, who would marry President Truman's daughter. So he must have had some inside knowledge to write. It's an amazing article. It really tells you about the great game, because after World War II, America's erstwhile allies, they were all competing against each other. And the French, the British, and the Russians were intensely jealous of the fact that the U.S. had gotten an exclusive concession to Saudi oil. But let me say one other thing that really affected my thinking. I sued the CIA under FOIA, Freedom of Information, and I got some more of my father's papers. And one of them was called an analysis of work, which was him sort of reporting back what his objectives were going to be when he was sent over to Lebanon in 1944. And it was very heavily redacted, but there was this line that was left unredacted. And what he said among top objectives of the U.S. foreign policy was, we must protect the oil at all costs. This really hit me, at all costs. And then I started following all the different wars in the Middle East, taking right up to the endless wars that we've had post 9/11. And the cost of these wars, it's just astronomical. And yet the people, American people, people worldwide, they don't know that it's big oil behind all of these wars.
And they're characterized, the narrative is that they're religious wars.
I mean, that gets fueled. I mean, obviously, there are religious differences or cultural differences that can be fueled. Divide and rule is a classic way to do that. And what I'm trying to do with my book is to take the conversation a step higher and say the same people who have been responsible for global warming, of lying about it, about its dangers, they're the same people that are bringing us these wars. Gaza, many people may not know, but right now there's $500 billion worth of oil and natural gas off the coast of Gaza, Israel, Lebanon. And that is looked upon by the West as a future source of energy, because Europe has become more energy insecure since, guess what, the war in Ukraine. It's all linked.
So now you characterize your father's death in the plane crash as mysterious. I mean, why so? Planes crash all the time. Wasn't your dad undercover? Wasn't he undercover?
That's a great question. No one's ever asked me that before. He was undercover. His cover was cultural attaché, because he was extremely knowledgeable about that part of the world. But that doesn't mean that at this point he wasn't known. He was known to be intelligence. I mean, I even have a report where he says, as soon as he's sent out there, he's saying, you know, the Brits know what I'm up to. I just want to let you know. By the time of his death, he was in charge of counterintelligence, which is sort of like the highest level of espionage. And what that is, you're trying to keep spies out of your assets and your your government, and you're going after them. And I would add that his primary counterpart in the Middle East is the most famous spy of the 20th century, and that was Kim Philby. Okay. Philby was working outside of
that. Did you ever solve the mystery, quote unquote, around the plane crash, or is just
I got a copy of the plane crash. I went to the National Archives, which is, by the way, one of my favorite places in the world. It is a fantastic font of information. And a lot of my father's papers were declassified, and I was able to get the accident report. And in the accident report, they were raising the question of sabotage, but they couldn't prove it at that time. Later on, an archivist took me to Fort Myers outside of Washington. There were spooks are getting together for drinks and conviviality, and I met one of the spooks that would later replace my father in the region. And I think he had a little bit too much wine, because he said, "Your father was a huge loss to us. We always thought it was sabotage, but we couldn't prove it." So that sort of validated my quest, and I kept hunting. And my book drops some various serious hints based on documented research that it likely was sabotage. There was an aerial camera on the plane, and that was to take pictures of pipeline routes. They were looking for oil in Ethiopia. And there was top secret equipment that was navigational equipment. The United States was about to set up a new airline, American-owned airline. I should say Ethiopian-owned, but American-managed. Ethiopian Airlines. Okay. That's the origin. Yeah.
All right. So, Charlotte Bennett, was that pipeline ever built, and where does it terminate?
The pipeline was built. And many people don't know this. It was only built, this was after my father died, in 1949. I should say, his last report talked about problems with Syria. Syria did not want the pipeline to traverse Syrian soil because they were opposed to the State of Israel. They were nationalists, and they didn't want that to happen. And so what happened is, after my father died, Archie Roosevelt replaced him, and that grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, and he was one of the instigators of a coup d'etat. In fact, it was the CIA's first ever coup, not in Iran in 1953, that overthrew the nationalist prime minister of Iran, Mossadegh. No, it was getting rid of the president of Syria because he objected to the pipeline going through Syria. And what they did is they installed in place of the president, an army chief who was okay with the pipeline going whichever way they wanted. And so there you go, the first coup. And it was built. It was built in 51, and it stayed in service until the mid-1990s when there was a civil war going on in Lebanon.
Okay.
There's
so now,
maybe efforts to renew it.
Okay. So this $500 billion worth of oil that you say is off the coast of Gaza, who's
controlling?
And Israel. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So who's controlling that? Is that oil being used, or is it just sitting there?
Well, first, who's controlling? Good question. Chevron.
Oh, okay.
And Chevron is the outgrowth of Standard Oil of California. This is one of Rockefeller's huge oil companies. And so they're still there big time in the Middle East. BP, British Petroleum, has also been involved. They initially were negotiating with the Gazans about exploiting what's called the Gaza Marine, but Israel would have none of it. And there were two invasions prior to the post-October 2023 invasion. One was in 2009 and the other was 2014. And the right-wing government of Israel did everything it could to prevent the oil getting into the hands of the Gazans. You know, they had great dreams that at least they would finally have some economic independence and that oil would help bring that to them. And it hasn't happened. It hasn't. They have the right to it. It's off their shores, but it has not. They have no right to it now.
Who's getting paid for that oil that Chevron and BP are?
Well,
are
Israel.
Using?
Israel obviously will get the royalties from the exploitation. That's the whole plan. And again, I mentioned that. You can't have, well, there's a huge infrastructure project now being planned. Netanyahu has always wanted to turn Israel into an energy corridor. It used to be energy dependent. In fact, Golda Meir, the famous first one of the prime minister of Israel, said, you know, the tragedy is that Moses led the people to Palestine where there was no oil. Well, that's all different now because of the discoveries in 2000 and 2010. Netanyahu has always wanted an energy corridor. He was very much behind the war in Iraq because he wanted to open up another pipeline that had been closed in 48 from Iraq to Haifa. And he bragged right after the invasion and said, soon the oil will be flowing to Israel. And it's not a pipe dream. But in fact, it was a pipe dream, because the person who was supposed to replace Saddam Hussein, Ahmad Shalabi, was the guy that had come up with the weapons of mass destruction fiction. So he became discredited. So that pipe dream never happened, but it may be realized now. And there are very big oil development plans in the region.
Mm-hmm. So you're listening to Charlotte Dennett, the author of Follow the Pipelines, Uncovering the Mystery of the Lost Spy and the Deadly Politics of the Great Gain of Oil. So Charlotte, so would you say that the genocide taking place in Gaza now is connected to that 500 billion, billion, because Israel is already controlling that, but the Gaza Marine, that's separate from the $500 billion of oil?
It's not separate. It's all part. It's called the Leviathan. And I have 12 maps in my book, and you can see the layout of the Leviathan there. But the point, as I was saying, they have big plans for the area, and I'll get into it. The latest one is called the IMEC, the India, Middle East, Europe Corridor. And that's going to have a pipeline from India underneath the Arabian Sea, going across Saudi Arabia and terminating in Haifa. And you can't build it if there's conflict. So what is the solution? You wipe it out. Flatten Gaza. Get rid of the people. Demilitarize it. Move them off the land. Commit ethnic cleansing and genocide. That's what we're watching. So it isn't just—it's not just a Riviera in the Middle East. You know, that's Trump's emphasis being real estate. No, there are much bigger stakes involved and much bigger money involved. It's tragic. It's horrible. And one of the things I learned in my investigation, it was from somebody from Alberta, Canada, where there's a lot of oil, and he told me, and this makes sense to me. He said, the oil majors, they'll stop at nothing, and not just the majors, you know, they'll stop at nothing to get the oil. They will assassinate, they will cause wars, they will invade, whatever it takes to get the oil, because oil is the fuel of the military. And this is why people never hear about the oil connection. It's still considered national security, and you know, I defy anyone to show me a show on cable TV, network TV, that gives an oil analysis to what's happening in Gaza. Some of it is becoming almost too obvious. For instance, Trump's going after India because it's buying oil from Russia. You know, but they're all trying to secure their oil supplies because they learned a message after World War I and World War II. Germany lost both those wars because its military machines ran out of gas.
So let's talk about the connection between the U.S. and Israel, because it seems to many people that Israel has the U.S. by the short hairs. I mean, whatever Israel says, they make the Congress people go to sojourns to Israel and whatnot. And what is that? Is that because Israel is controlling the oil and the U.S. wants to make sure it stays in good standing with Israel?
Well put. I remember a time when I was with my family. We were in Lebanon during a family reunion, and I was laying out all the pipeline maps that are in my book. And I was trying to figure out what was protecting the oil of Saudi Arabia, which ended up in southern Lebanon, but only 100 miles from the border of Israel. And I was looking at it and thinking, where is this military base? And it suddenly hit me. It's Israel. Israel is the military base that is protecting American oil interests in the Middle East, because their pipelines are terminating. They're trying to get pipelines that were closed reopened, because there's such a huge need for this energy. And as I say, Europe has definitely wanted to get a hold of some of that offshore oil from Israel, because, you know, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was closed, that was going to deliver more Russian oil to Europe. And it got closed basically by the Biden administration. They convinced Germany to not go ahead with it, and then it was sabotage. So they were meeting even before October 2002-03. The G20 nations had signed a memorandum of understanding, and the whole idea is they were going to exploit the oil off the coast of Israel, the oil and the natural gas, to go to Europe, so that it wouldn't be so energy dependent on the Russians. It's all bypass games. They're all competing against each other to find new sources of oil to feed their militaries.
Politicians have skillfully changed the narrative to make this conflict about the big bad Hamas, when it seems Hamas is the only thing standing between Israel seizing control of the Palestinian oil and gas. And at one point, former Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat said that the Gaza Marines are a gift from God to the Palestinian people. But it looks like, go ahead.
That's true. I mean, you know, whatever people may think about Hamas, under international law, they have the right to defend themselves against occupation. But you see, the propaganda that has come out of the United States and Israel, its chief ally in the region, has been so overwhelming that just people aren't getting the truth. And it's been very hard. As you know, anyone who criticizes Israel is accused of being anti-Semitic. And the way I'd like to sort of defeat that idea is that in 1944, the first people to ever use the slogan, "No blood for oil," were Jews who had escaped the Holocaust, made their way down to Palestine, and had learned that one of the reasons that the Roosevelt administration had delayed rescuing the Jews was because he was concerned about securing the oil of Saudi Arabia. The king of Saudi Arabia had said, if you create this state, the state of Israel, your oil concessions are going to suffer. And eventually, FDR was able to work out a deal with Saudi Arabia. But in 44, there could have been a key rescue mission. I won't go into the details, but it didn't happen. And that's because of concern about Saudi oil. So it was the Jews who knew about it. But also in 44, there began this whole weaponization of anti-Semitism that was, you can't criticize Israel. And of course, there it was much more potent, because the Holocaust was, you know, it was with everybody. It was horrible. It was horrific. So that has been a very useful propaganda tool. Not that there isn't anti-Semitism in the world. I'm just saying, you know, it got weaponized, used against critics. Yeah.
And you said, I think, in your book, that real Jews and Christians don't support Israel.
Well, I mean, real. I don't know if I'd say.
Okay.
I think that increasing numbers is the way I would put it. That got put in the press release. That I would say increasing numbers do not support this war, because I mean, it's genocide. It's plain as day. We're watching it on TV, and it's horrific, because we sit here powerless and we wonder why the West isn't intervening. And I'm giving you a economic reason. Lots of money to be made on pipeline schemes.
Charlotte Vinette, attorney and investigative journalist and author of Follow the Pipelines, Uncovering the Mystery of the Lost Spy and the Deadly Politics of the Great Game for Oil. And congratulations on your dad Daniel Dennett's work, outstanding work as a master spy for America.
Yeah, I was critical of the CIA. I got to say, my previous book was Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon. But he was very unusual. And you'll read about it in the book.
All right. Thank you so much for being our guest this week on What's at Stake.
Thank you, Marina.
That's going to do it for this week's What's at Stake. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Julianne Malveau, and our investigative journalist and author, Charlotte Dinette. Also give thanks to our engineer, Mike Masella, and to you, the listener, for joining us. Next week, Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo will be in the host seat. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late, great Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
The Can I Kick It outdoor summer movie series presented by Shaolin Jazz is back and is coming to Southeast DC for the first time ever. Enjoy 3 nights of martial arts and action films scored live with hip hop, soul, and more, mixed by WPFW alum DJ Two-Tone Jones. Saturday, September 20th at Skyland Town Center with a screening of Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon. Then on Saturday, October 25th, the series concludes with the screening of I'm Going to Get You Sucker at the Capitol Hill Boys Club Artist Gallery. Each event begins at 7 p.m. with a guest DJ set, followed by the movie at 8:30 p.m. Blankets and lawn chairs are welcome. For more details, visit shaolinjazz.com. shaolinjazz.com.
The United Black Community presents the 21st annual Love Supreme, a musical, poetic birthday tribute to another root, John Coltrane, featuring the Nasa Abaday Quintet, Cindy Brown, Kenny Carroll, Nana Malaya, and more on Friday, September 19, 2025 at 7 p.m. at E-Life Restaurant, 9033 Central Avenue, Capitol Heights, Maryland. Details, UBC in D.C. at yahoo.com, 240-832-7203. Thank you.
I'm Jackie Lukeman, chairperson of the Black Alliance for Peace Coordinating Committee, with an editorial. Donald Trump imposed federal control of the Metropolitan Police Department and deployed the National Guard in Washington, D.C. under the pretext of public safety. This follows his March 2025 executive order establishing the Safe and Beautiful Task Force aimed at addressing crime in D.C. and after the Secure D.C. Omnibus Bill was passed, the latest in Democrat crime laws that have devastated marginalized communities, particularly Black, African, working class, and youth. Now Trump goes further and invokes law and order to justify military occupation. Militarized domestic occupation that advances as the U.S. and the West deepen their support for the Zionist genocide in Gaza, while they normalize repression of the global masses struggling against and resisting them. We must confront the colonial capitalist structures and oppressive class rule that made all of this possible. We must fight Trump's authoritarianism, but we must also fight Democrat tough-on-crime criminalization of poverty and dissent. And we must fight for a future where safety is not imposed by militarization, but built through structures of popular democracy, peace, social justice, and collective liberation. The Black Alliance for Peace says, end the colonial occupation of Washington, D.C. No justice, no peace, no compromise, no retreat. The full statement can be found at blackallianceforpeace.com/BAP statements. This has been Jackie Lukeman, chairperson of the Black Alliance for Peace Coordinating Committee, with an editorial.
WPFW presents Genius plus Soul equals Ray and John. Tuesday, September 23rd, 5 a.m. until midnight. This will be a fundraising birthday tribute like no other, illuminating the lives and contributions of Ray Charles and John Coltrane, two icons of American music. Schedule and details at wpfwfm.org, where you can also contribute anytime. WPFW, preserving the culture, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, is seeking a leader to serve as WPFW's next general manager. We are looking